Hello, everyone, and welcome to my podcast, Body Justice. I started this podcast because I believe that all bodies are good bodies. All bodies are deserving, worthy, and all bodies are whole just as they are. In today's world, it's ever hard to embody this as our truth. My mission is to create a space to process body image, eating disorders, and relationships through a justice-oriented lens. I'm a licensed therapist in California and an eating disorder survivor myself. I know what it's like to be at war with myself and also to find peace again. Thank you for being here, and I look forward to being your host. Hey everyone, we are back with another episode of Body Justice. I'm so excited to be doing this show again. I've received some really positive feedback from you all about restarting it in my last episode, and that really just gives me so much encouragement. So I just want to say thank you so much. I'm really excited for the interviews and recordings we have coming up. So if you haven't already, please rate and review Body Justice on Apple or Spotify. Both is wonderful. One is great. Really appreciate the support. It really helps the podcast reach more people. And as always, you can learn more about me and my practice on Instagram at bodyjustice.therapist, as well as our website, www.eatingdisorderocdtherapy.com. We have individual therapy in California, Utah, and Florida. We have in-person sessions in San Diego, California, and we also provide ketamine-assisted therapy. So please feel free to check us out. Today, we are going to talk to Kevin from the Instagram handle at KevinDoesRFID. We're going to talk all about RFID and what mainstream eating disorder treatment gets wrong about folks with RFID. RFID is a lesser-known eating disorder, and yeah, there's just so many misconceptions that harm people with RFID. So we're going to take a deep dive into it. Kevin also has lived experience of RFID. And so the perspective that they are going to give us is really, really great. And, you know, comes right from someone living with it, as well as someone who does professional work in the eating disorder community in terms of supporting people with RFID. So without further ado, let's get started. Okay, today we have Kevin here on Body Justice. I'm going to let them introduce themselves and then we'll dive into RFID. Kevin, tell us a little bit about you.
Heck yeah. My name is Kevin. My pronouns are they, them. About me. I'm a cat dad with my loving fiance. I'm a peer mentor, peer specialist, whatever you want to call it, in the eating disorder world. Yeah, I'm an artist, I'm disabled. Just kind of doing all a bunch of weird different things all the time. I feel like there's no good title for what I do. I just kind of do a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's true. You do a lot of different things, but very important things.
That's fair. Yeah, very important things, just things that sometimes don't have titles, which is okay.
And also that's frustrating because like you're such a needed voice in this field. That's why I'm so excited to talk to you today and like have the listeners hear more about you and your work.
Heck yeah.
Because you are literally like my go-to and my only go-to for RFID. Like,
That makes me so happy and so sad at the same time.
I know, same. It's like, that's so not okay. And I'm so glad to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in working with RFID?
Yeah, so I went through treatment myself in 2020, 2021. And I was not diagnosed with RFID because you, quote, can't have like body issues, body dysmorphia issues, if you also have RFID, which is just not true. But in the DSM, it is. So like many other people, I was just diagnosed with anorexia, went through some pretty like harmful and terrible treatment at a center where I am in. And when I left, I was like, well, that really sucked. I need to like now figure out my own stuff, I guess. And I wasn't set up with an aftercare team at all. So I really had to like figure it out on my own. And I found a dietitian through the Fed Up Collective, their dietitian match program. And within like 5 minutes of meeting, she was like, yeah, you have RFID. I was like, that's wild. And then kind of cycled through a few therapists, a few dietitians, a few med providers, just trying to like land somewhere. And then last year, I thought I found a really good dietitian, a like in-person dietitian to work with. I was really excited and pumped for it. And then I had a hard time doing an exposure and was essentially told, like, you're not trying and you're not ready, so like come back when you're ready, which filled me with so much rage. So I created my Instagram page because I was like, somebody needs to talk about this, somebody needs to do something about it, and I guess nobody's gonna do it, so I'll do it, question mark. And from there it just kind of snowballed into like doing consults, and like now my full-time job is working in the eating disorder field. So it was a very fast but also slow spiral into where I am now.
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, it's so wonderful to see you taking such a like stance in the eating disorder field. And I hate that it came from this place of just like being chronically misunderstood and being exposed to these like harmful treatment approaches. Because literally, yeah, before I started learning about more about ARFID from you, I was trained that it's all about exposure, you know, like exposing and increasing the variety, and that it's like this form of picky eating. Can you tell us a little bit about like what exactly is ARFID and what are some of those misconceptions?
Yeah, those misconceptions drive me wild. So I tend to think of ARFID as like a feeding difference. I don't really love classifying it as an eating disorder. I would suggest talking to like Noreen over at RDACE for neurodiversity, because that's her work and she speaks on it better. But so I've now adapted to like feeding differences, feeding whatever you want to call it, post an eating disorder. But when I first talk about ARFID, I see it in like two boxes of like, you have this attached to your neurodivergence, or you had trauma happen to you. And then after you kind of decide which box you're in, there's three more boxes, which is like you have a lot of issues with like the sensory aspect of eating, which is probably one of the more common parts of it. So these are kids that like, or adults that love to like eat all of their food separate. Like when I have, for example, a hamburger, sometimes I'll put the condiments on the side and dip it. That way it's not on it. Or like pasta, I like the sauce separate and then I dip it in the sauce, because all the sensory things together is too much sometimes. Then you have your kids that just have lack of interest, so they literally have no interest in eating. They don't have hunger cues, they don't have fullness cues. Like I could go the rest of my life without eating and it wouldn't make me sad at all. And not from a like restrictive, I want to be small, just like I literally have no interest. It like is very rare that I'm excited about food, and when I am excited about food, my fiance makes sure I get it, because it's so rare that it happens. What? I can think of like two meals that I would be sad about missing, and like that's about it. So I love Red Robin's Whiskey River Burger, which is like, it has like fried onions that don't, they're so fried that they're like not slimy, and it has barbecue sauce and cheese, and it's just a burger. And then their pretzel bites and their beer cheese.
Ooh.
I could drink their beer cheese if it was like socially acceptable. I would ask for a tall glass of it. It's so good. I'm trying to think of what else. I really love cheese and bread. So like that, but past that, I would like be fine. And then the third one is fear of adverse consequences. So like these are the people that are like, I choked one time when I was eating a sandwich, and now everything in that sandwich I can't eat because I will choke. Or kids who are afraid of getting sick and vomiting, so they just don't try new foods, because maybe they tried a new food once doing ERP and you're supposed to try it 15 times before deciding if you like it, which is fucking bananas. But say on try 9, they choke and gag. Now every other try is just going to be horrible. So those are three subtypes. You can have all two of them, one of them, and...
Yeah, that's also making me think of how, like, you know, with the subtype of how a fear is attached to the food in terms of like, I might choke or whatever. I could see that also being in like the OCD realm, you know, like it's interesting to see like how it co-occurs with these other forms of neurodivergence.
A crossover is, yeah, I was just talking about this with some coworkers about how like deciphering against OCD and ARFID, which is a whole other conversation I will not get into, but it is very difficult to do.
Yeah. Do you have like a infographic on your Instagram of these different, this like sort of flow chart you just described?
No, but I should.
You should make that. I feel like that's like very helpful for people to understand like the reality of ARFID, not just this diagnostic criteria.
Yeah, I've posted a lot about it, but I should make some more like flow chart-y printout things. It's a good idea.
That would be so helpful. And everyone listening should like go pay Kevin for their work, because yeah, they do a lot of free labor and education. So I guess we touched on some of it, but is there any other like misconceptions about ARFID that really just grind your gears?
Yeah, I mean, the misconception that it's just picky eating will forever and ever. And the fact that, like, I mean, you know me, I'm petty, so I don't care. But, like, the fact that 90% of the people on the internet that post about ARFID, like, have picky eating in their bio or in their handle, but then in the same breath will be like, no, I treat ARFID. It's like, no, you don't. Not if that's how you're seeing it. So, like, people like that really get me going. When people say that there's, like, when people try to be good, especially at big organizations who will like post about ARFID once a year during eating disorder awareness week and share that like there's no body issues. And it's like, okay, so now we're getting the light and we're getting seen once a year and it's the wrong information. That really gets me. This idea that like everybody with ARFID is like malnourished tiny toddlers in the hospital when it's like every body, every weight, every age, everything. You know, the usual.
Yeah, no, that's so frustrating because it creates this like picture of ARFID that isn't real, like reality.
And I hate that the people with the biggest followings tend to use the worst language. And I'm like, God, No.
I didn't even realize there was people with like in their handles like picky eating, like. Gosh, okay, I'm gonna have to go look at all those people. Yeah,
yourself to get angry.
How do body image issues tie into ARFID, or are they something that just co-occur?
I think it's a bigger part. Okay, so when we think of ARFID, there are so many. Like, I don't know many people with ARFID that aren't like autistic or have EDS or like are neurodivergent in some flavor or chronically ill. I know a few people with ARFID that like have it from trauma of food, and like those people tend to not have like the is there a different word for comorbidities? Like coexisting things? Like
that. Yeah.
But like coexisting diagnoses. It's wild because like you think of autistic people who are like, some are hypersensitive of their body. Like I can feel food going down my throat. I can feel it in my stomach digesting. And everyone's like, no, you can't. I'm like, yes, I can. And like when I get IV liquid, I can feel the liquid going through my veins and everyone's like, no, you can't. Like, yes, I can. So to then be like, you can't have body image issues and ARFID. It's like kids are so, or whoever is hyper aware of their body. Like we all live in the same society of diet culture and like we're all getting the same messages, and like fat people with ARFID still can't access like clothing or seats on the plane. Or like, I was so upset. I went to go on the carousel this week in Seattle and the weight limit was like 200 pounds. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? I just want to go on a fucking carousel.
Yeah.
But like, and that made me hate myself for a hot second. And like, I still have ARFID. Yeah. That one really gets me going.
That makes so much sense though. It ignores people with ARFID in diverse bodies. Like,
yeah,
because the same could be true. Like for someone I'm thinking that's BIPOC and has ARFID, like you're still going to have feelings about your body because of the society we live in.
Yeah, and it would be wild to be like, no, you can't have ARFID because you don't like your body. It's like, give me somebody that's not engaging in some kind of disordered something that likes their body. Like that, I don't know, but unless they've worked like for decades on like radical self-love and all of that jazz, I don't know anybody that like is 100% about their body all the time. So the like that be a major criteria cutoff is wild.
That excludes so many people. For sensitivity part, that's so interesting. Like I could see that getting totally dismissed by people that neurotypical people that don't have that experience to just be like, no, there's no way you can feel that.
Yeah. And like being bloated, and like especially when we think about neurodivergent folks and like interoceptive skills, I don't get hunger cues. And then I don't really get full until I'm so full that I'm like physically uncomfortable. And everyone's like, you only took so many bites. It's like, yes. And my interoceptive skills are wild. And like my hunger cues are wild. Like these things just don't work in my brain. So like I feel bloated, probably more bloated than others feel, not as like a competitive thing, but just like I'm so aware of my body senses. So then to turn around and be like, you can't hate your body. It's like, well, that. Okay.
Sure. Yeah. Like if that worked, like we'd all be cured. That is, yeah, that's interesting because I feel like this, I've always wondered, is this in my mind or is this part of my like neurodivergence? But like, I swear I can feel when my body changes just slightly. Like I can really can feel it. And it can be so distressing, and not even because of the appearance per se, but just how it feels, like just feeling foreign in your body, I guess.
Yeah.
But that is not talked about anywhere.
Nope.
And I can imagine if you can literally feel food digest and like drinks and stuff, I'm sure, like going down. That must be so, yeah, that would just totally change anyone's eating experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. And I think it's because like our fit before was like what, child, adolescent feeding disorder syndrome, something. So I mean, not to say babies can't have body image issues, but I'm assuming when the DSM was written and it was added 10 years ago, it was just like looking at toddlers and children with ARFID who aren't like having the language to be like, this feels wrong in my tummy or something. Like, it's very dismissive.
Now that's making me wonder, when you were a baby, if you could feel like the different, or if you could have that hyper awareness even as a baby drinking milk.
Yeah, I don't know if I was a baby. I would have to ask my mom, but I know like growing up, especially I spent like a lot of time in the hospital as a kid, I could always like feel like when I had the feeding tube and they were like, you can't feel it. It's like, no, I can feel it touching every inch of my body. And when liquid would go down, they'd be like, no, you can't feel that. I'm like, no, I literally could feel absolutely everything. But even to this day, like when I was in the hospital 2 years ago for some heart issues, they put an IV in my arm. And I was like, that is very, very sore. And it doesn't like, I can feel all the liquids you're putting in it. And they're like, that's not real. Nobody can feel the liquid in their veins. So for 12 hours, I just like had to have the uncomfortable IV because they refused to move it. And I had no energy. And then finally the nurse the next day was like, no, I believe you. Like my kid can also like, is autistic and can feel things in their veins. So she finally moved it, but like, it shouldn't take all of that. Like I should just be trusted and listened to.
Right. Like what's the big deal with just accommodating that when it's, seems like it was easily accommodated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very quick. Just an IV change. And like, you don't have to experience it, but like accommodate it.
Right.
You
exactly.
Just have to trust the people experiencing it.
Yeah. Like, why else would someone say that? Like what's.
Yeah. I don't know anyone that's like running around the hospital unless they're like not having their best day. It's just like, I can feel the things in my veins. Like nice. That feels pretty like you should listen to that.
Yes, absolutely. That's also making me think about people who get like forced tube feeds and stuff, like how freaking traumatic that will be.
Yeah.
And on every level, in a sensory level, especially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of that post Jenny sent us where somebody was like, compassionate forced feed tubing. You cannot use those four words in the same fucking sentence.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So bad. I think it was like compassionate restrained feeding or something. Like, ooh, like that's really not okay.
No.
You might like, I would rather the person just say restrained forced feeding. Like, don't put compassionate on it. That just makes it grosser.
Yeah, don't try to make yourself feel better.
Right. Oof. What do you think we need to do to help improve the lives of people with ARFID?
So much. That's it. No, I mean, I feel like I always say that like care needs to be patient focused and like literally patient focused. So I feel like a lot of people claim that they're patient focused. It's like, I don't think you actually know what that means. Or it's like patient focused until the patient questions the clinician and then it's what's happening. I'm right, you're wrong focused.
Mm.
But I think people need to like look past ERP also, like that is not the only way to accommodate ARFID. I think when people like send their kids to treatment for ARFID, they're like, now fix it. And it's like, well, sometimes your kid just has ARFID and like I can do my best to like help them expand the food they already like and like explore what's making them anxious, but like to just toss your kid in a treatment center to like fix it. Like that's not always how it works. I think the narrative around even what recovery is, because especially working in the eating disorder field, like recovery from anorexia and recovery from ARFID, not the same. And like recovery from binge eating and recovery from ARFID, not the same.
Mm-hmm.
ARFID is, and why I don't even like calling it an eating disorder is because it's just so different and needs like such a different approach.
Yeah.
Especially when we think about like, I'm just going to name modalities, but literally any modality that like takes away autonomy. Our people with ARFID literally crave autonomy, especially our neurodivergent people. Like they have they feel like they have no control in their body, and like their body is not their own, and like they're constantly being told to like be less and be smaller and be quieter. So then to like have the one thing you can control also taken away is super triggering. So I always talk about like, obviously the kid's not like writing a meal plan and like going grocery shopping by themselves, but like maybe we're like presenting a few meals that they could have and then they're picking. So it's not like free reign, but it's also like you still are having a say. And it's like, well, obviously you're not going to let the kid just pick anything in the grocery store to try for the first time because we don't know how they're going to react and like yada yada. But again, maybe we pick like five things or like an aisle they can go down. It's like autonomy, but like appropriate appropriate autonomy, not controlled autonomy, but like contained.
Compassionate restrained autonomy.
Compassionately restrained autonomy.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Like including them in it, and like maybe like you have a list of foods they would like to try and you kind of gradually try those things out instead of all at once buying them, because who can afford that? But yeah, that would make sense to just kind of expand based on their preferences and desires.
Yeah, I also feel like there's such like a, I know for my own treatment, when I ask why, that kind of throws providers off. And then providers are like, because that's how we do it. And it's like, if you have a kid that's asking why, like that's either because they want to know or they're anxious or like they just need more information. So every time one of my patients is like, but why do I have to try it? And then their care team is just like, because that's what we're doing. It's like, that's not an answer, actually. And these people should be, especially the kiddos who literally have no autonomy, should be a simple answer to why is like not that hard.
Right.
Give. It's like a weird control hierarchy thing to just say, because I told you so. Like, that's not real.
That makes me like instantly lose respect for someone. Like, if you can't explain why, maybe you should not be doing that thing.
Yeah, maybe you should not be in the helping field if like why upsets you.
Right. Oh my gosh, gross. So what happens if you get a client and let's say they have a really limited amount of like preferred or safe foods and they're not getting all their nutritional needs met, but they are not ready to expand on things. Mm-hmm. What do you do in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, my first thing is always like quantity over quality or whatever it is. So like just eat more of your safe foods. Mm-hmm. Like if I have a kid who's only eating like bagels and cream cheese and Cheez-Its, stick. Now you're just going to eat more bagels and cream cheese and Cheez-Its.
Yeah.
I always recommend Enough Powder, which is ENOF, which is literally they cover vegetables in vegetable oil and then they freeze dry it so none of the nutrients are leaving, and then they grind it up, and like a half a teaspoon is a full serving of vegetables. Like that's a very easy, accessible way to like be like, hey, I'm gonna put this in your food. Obviously don't do it without telling them, but it's like full of stuff and like explaining why. That's a great one. Always supplements. I think people look past the milkshake diet, which I went on when I first had like my first ARFID affirming dietitian. Literally drank a milkshake every single day, but like you can use Boost instead of milk, and then boom, you have more protein. You can add the powder, you can like add things to their already safe foods. Mm-hmm. And then it's just like bridging when the kid is ready. And like if kid loves plain pasta but you want them to eat like pasta with the red sauce and Enough Powder in it, cool, put it in a cup on the side so that they can dip and it's not like a brand new experience, they still have their safe food. So situations like that, I don't think that's a situation where you jump in and you're like, okay, exposures, because first, like, rapport building question mark. I'm not going to force any child to do an exposure for at least like 2 months of meeting with them, because again, rapport building, that safety like has to be there. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
force them after the 2 months.
What's up?
Are you going to force them after the 2 months?
Oh yeah, on month two it's like, all right, fucking I'm at your door knocking with a food in your mouth. No, at the 2 month mark it's like, okay, like we've been getting to know each other for a while, I like working with you, I feel like I trust you, how do you feel about like trusting me? And then it's always like a safety word or like a safety action or like a sign of some sort that things are beginning to be too much, especially with the neurodivergent kids. And then like always expecting that. I always plan for the worst, which maybe isn't ideal always, but in my job it is, because if you like go in and you're like, yeah, this kid's gonna kill this exposure, they're gonna nail it, and then they freak out, and then you're like, oh shit. So I always have a backup plan in the back of my head in case things go south very, very quickly. But I don't know. I've never forced a child to try an exposure. And if a team I've been on has done that, I apologize and like try to explain why things are happening the way they're happening and like try to like help them self-advocate and also learn to like quote trust the process. It's very murky waters, one would say.
I think that would be very murky waters. And like, I hope that, you know, where you're working can really learn from you and be much more gentle and like autonomy based.
We're trying.
And like, it's interesting because like the 15 times rule, like that's not something someone without ARFID would ever do. Like if you
no.
don't, you wouldn't force yourself to try it 15 times to make sure you didn't like it.
No, I always live by the no thank you bite rule. So I will forever try something once. I mean, there's like a few things that like never put that in front of me. Absolutely no. But like everything else, I'm willing to take a no thank you bite, but the autonomy to not take that no thank you bite also needs to exist.
Yeah.
And I'm especially thinking about like my kiddos with like PDA who try, or demand avoidance, who try to like do exposures. I always do exposures with the kids. That way it's not like I'm just like staring at you and like begging for you to do this thing. It's like, I'm going to try this food and like, and then I'll explain the texture and like, I'll explain how I like it. And then usually they're like, all right. They're not telling me to do this. They're doing it and now I'm going to do it. And it's going to be a cool time.
I love that. I always do exposures with clients too.
Yeah. I had a kiddo transferred over to my caseload and like, nobody had ever offered to do an exposure with them and they hadn't done any exposure work yet. And then I offered and then they magically also like they licked something day one of meeting with me to do exposure work. And I was like, that it's so simple to just like also show up and like also because it also like shows them that's not scary. And like, look, Kevin chewed a waffle and like chewed it enough and like swallowed and had some juice and everything was fine. Yeah, the mirroring part.
Totally. And it's like, it really helps the relationship be less hierarchical, like as much as we can make it. Like we shouldn't be asking our clients to do things we wouldn't do. And it also just feels like sadistic to like, just sit there and watch someone do an exposure. Like, what is this?
Yeah. I remember the first time I did exposure and that was kind of the vibe. I was just like, this is so off-putting. It's so uncomfortable. But again, like, nobody's teaching people this. Like, this is not like very off-putting. I remember there was one day he came on me to try like a protein drink, and I was like, "Oh, I dumped it into my Red Solo cup," and like wasn't the same protein drink, but it was a protein drink. So there are times that like it's a little white lie-y because I'm like, "Well, I am trying something, just not the exact same."
Right.
But you know, do what you gotta do.
Yeah, and also, I'm imagining, so if the texture or there's some sensory aspect to the food that the client isn't liking and that's why they're not expanding, would you then help them sort of modify the sense, if it's possible to sort of modify that experience? Like it, maybe it's temperature or maybe it's texture, doing like cooking it in a different way.
Yeah, so one I always recommend to people is like, every kid I meet, almost every kid is like, I don't like chunky sauce. And it's like, sick, blend your pizza sauce, blend your tomato sauce, blend your soups. Like, blenders exist and we can use them for a reason. But yeah, also on temperature stuff, like I have a lot of kids that like don't love leftovers just because like the texture is weird in the microwave. And it's like, okay, microwave the thing that's good in the microwave and then air fry the thing that's good in the air fryer and like accommodating ways to move things. But the blender one is the one I use the most and people are always blown away with it because it's usually like, well, I want to try like a meat sauce but I really don't like chunks of tomato. Like, okay, so blend the tomato sauce first. Or like, I love when Hef, my fiance, makes like shredded chicken in the crock pot for tacos. That is made with a jar of salsa, but I do not like chunks, so he blends the salsa and then you just like add a little bit of cornstarch to thicken it up. I think those ways. And then like another good way is just like, I don't know, if you're having like baked potatoes, instead of assembling it all, like have a baked potato bar. Like, things don't have to be pre-done. But yeah, stuff like that is usually what I tend to suggest.
I love that, like just kind of getting creative about I feel like I do that in terms of working with people with OCD. Like there's so many ways to like modify an exposure to make it more accessible.
Yeah. And also like don't have to sit at the, I have so many clients I've been told that like they have to sit at the table. And it's like, if you want, I had this kid that like sits in his man cave and it's just like a bean, it's a bunch of bean bags in the corner of a room and he tried something there. It's like, I don't care if you're at your kitchen table or like on the top of your car or outside, or like, I don't care where you are as long as it's like a private area. And then also like this weird idea of like first day you have to eat it. I hate that. It's like first day, if you even smell it or like pick it up, fantastic. I always have kids interact with the food with all your senses first. I think telling a kid to just bite something willingly is very scary. And also like might be controversial, but I always say fuck the utensils when you're trying food, because like feel the food, like experiment what it feels like on your hands, like
yes,
mush it up, play with it. Like why aren't we, I play with my food all the time and like it makes me feel safer. And that's when it's like, okay, well, is this like an eating disorder or OCD behavior, or is this just like a way to make food easier? Like
right.
That one always is very controversial though. I'm a finger eater personally.
Yeah, that's sad that that's controversial, because like for one, sorry, there's this big street sweeper outside. I don't know if you can hear it.
No.
Perfect. For one, like that's how many cultures eat. Like in Filipino culture and Indonesian culture, many different cultures, you eat with your hands.
Yeah.
You don't eat with forks.
And you eat on the floor and you like eat in different places and like it's so odd. And like the no distractions. It's like you're asking a child to like interact with a food that scares them, and now you want them to just like neurotypically sit there and be uncomfortable. That's so uncomfortable. No, thank you.
I love that.
Neurotypically sit there.
Yeah. No, and also, like, that is how babies learn to eat and be exposed to new foods. Like, they eat their hands and they get really messy, but that's okay.
And they
the whole
explore
sensory
it.
Experience. And also, it looks like they're having a lot of fun. Like, why not?
Killing.
Yeah.
And like for me, it was growing up, it was like I was told there's not, it was always onions or mushrooms. It was always, there's not onions or mushrooms or tomatoes in your food. And then there always was. So like to use a fork and have to like blindly trust what is on my plate, it's like, no, I would rather use my little fingers and like be able to know exactly what I'm about to interact with. And again, it's like people I've worked with have been like, well, that's a behavior. And it's like, that is an accommodation. It's not enabling. It's like having compassion and actual compassion, not like false compassion.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. How do you think of the difference between an accommodation versus a behavior?
Ooh, that's a good one. I always say, and I think it's the same for eating disorders and OCD, if you could live, like I can't eat with a fork. I don't like to. So like if I went to a restaurant and it was like a sign that said forks have to be used, I would be okay. But I think that, so that would be like the accommodation part of it. Like I can live without that action. But if it was like Kevin will have a panic attack if they can't eat without their fingers, I would think that's more behavioral-y. Like for OCD, like when I leave the house, I always check the lock twice. And it's like, that is causing actual, nope. Like that's, I could do without it, but like, I feel significantly safer doing it. So that kind of like walks the line. I think it becomes an issue if you're like avoiding things and like saying no to going to things, and like it's taking up a lot of mental energy, then I would be a little bit more worried about if it's behavior. But if it like makes you feel like actually safer and like that anxiety is not going to pop up 2 minutes later after you've done like a compulsion, but I think the line is very, very liney, very blurry.
Totally. That's how usually I describe it with OCD too. It's like, is there a fear associated to not doing it?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like even if there is a fear, it's not like grounds to then, okay, we challenge that now. It's like accommodation versus behavior. It matters and it doesn't matter, right? Because it's like either way, it deserves compassion, and like we can accommodate the fear if it is a fear.
Yeah. And I also think there are so many things that I do related to my OCD or my ARFID that I'm like, these take 2 seconds. They're not harming anybody. It would take more energy to not do them. So like checking the lock, it's so much easier to just check the lock than obsessively worry if I've checked the lock for the next 6 hours. It's easier to just use my fingers than to like worry if I'm going to get something uncomfortable in my food. And I also think it like depends on what the client feels. Yeah. Obviously, if they're like deep in their OCD and like need our help seeing that, that's a different thing. But like, I don't get to decide what is like what. And then mm-hmm. it comes into like, okay, well, if that client's not willing to challenge it, now they're non-compliant, and it's like, you know, they're self-advocating. So many thoughts and words and situations.
Yeah, that's so good to sort of like explore that nuance though, because I feel like that this stuff isn't really talked about much.
Never.
No. What are things that like really helped you in your own ARFA journey?
Community. I think community has been one of the only helpful things. I mean, I have a fantastic dietitian, so like finding a dietitian, but also community and like finding roots in community that is like anti-carceral and like very deep in harm reduction. And like, I know for our group of friends, nobody's ever just gonna like call the cops on me, which is very important. But like in other situations, it's like if I go out to eat with a bunch of friends, it's like nobody's gonna be like saying weird things to me or like making comments about my food. So I think that's the biggest one. And then like, much as it sucks, like learning how to self-advocate or like having somebody that can help you. So recently I've added my fiance to like people my doctor can talk to, because I'm like, I don't have the mental energy to do that right now. So like, I'm going to load that off on you. And then it's always like vetting people and like asking around. Like, I would never suggest somebody just Google like ARFA dietitian and like click the first one that comes up. Don't do that. I always suggest that's where community comes in again, and like asking like, what has worked for you? Where have you gone that has been helpful? And like always checking that out. And also like, I don't know. I could go on and on about like trusting medical people, but finding people that like aren't just going to say, well, you need to stop eating this and this, or you're going to die. And it's like, well, I'm not going to stop eating this and this, and I'm also not going to die. So maybe don't put that thought into my head. But past that, I don't know. I always suggest people like I have a sometimes always never list of food that is just like, makes it easier if I can't pick what I want to eat. I'm just like, go to the list.
Yes.
And that takes a lot of energy out of my brain.
I love that post.
Yeah. And I also have friends, like sometimes I'll text Jenny or I'll text my friend back. But like, here are my three options. Please just pick one. Don't ask me any questions. And that's super helpful too. I think one of the bigger things too that Heth learned from my friend Quinn, especially if you have like demand avoidance issues, if I'm overwhelmed when I'm cooking and something goes wrong, that's it. Dinner's over. I'm going to bed. I'm not eating. I'm a terrible chef. Take my degree. And it's like, that is a very extreme thing to happen, but that's just where my brain goes, because I'm already overwhelmed with food 24/7. So something Heth has learned is like, I have a list of three things that I will always eat. If you put it in front of me, it will be consumed. So when I'm overwhelmed, my demand avoidance is like really activated. He will not ask. He will just cook it. He will put it in front of me and fucking walk away and leave me alone. Oh my God. It's literally the most helpful thing. And like, he doesn't like search for praise, or like, he doesn't be like, is it good? Do you need something? Blah, blah, blah. He just puts it there and fucking leaves me alone. And then he doesn't say anything later unless I say something. It's like when you see your therapist in public, he does not interact unless I interact, which has been very, very helpful. And also like the friends and stuff, like, my friends will send me what's going to be at a party beforehand and be like, do you want me to cook anything else? Or like, do you want to bring something? Which then I'll bring like a serving and a half, because I know nobody else is going to eat it, but then at least I have food.
Yeah.
But I think that all just ties back to community. So long answer that, short answer, community.
I love that. That's such an important piece. And like, building community, even if the other people don't have ARFID, obviously it's awesome if some do, but if they don't, like, people that are willing to learn and be like, and just believe you, right?
Yeah.
Like, accommodate you. Like, I love that your partner does that. That is so wonderful. And that always, you said always, maybe never list. That is so helpful. You have that in a post or in your link in bio or both?
Both, I think.
Both, yeah. Okay.
I did make a post about that and bridging food. Those were like a combo post. Yeah.
Yes. Anyone who is like relating to this, you should definitely go check out Kevin's Instagram and look at those posts, because I found that so helpful and encouraged, I think it was one of my clinicians, to use that with their client with ARFID. Yeah.
Nice. Because I feel like in the moment, stuff is so hard. And if you could just have it all written out, and I shared that list with my dietitian, so like she's on it and she knows what's happening with it. And then that also is like, if Kevin wants to try an exposure, I could try so many things, but now somebody else can just look at the list and be like, hey, yes, this is on your list. You want to go for that? And that's so nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes you really just need someone to choose for you.
Yes.
I remember like when I was in like really active recovery, it was so hard to make a choice and I didn't always have someone around me. So what I did was like, I wrote down different options that I knew I'd be
roll okay. Roll the dice.
Yeah. And I would roll the dice or like draw one from the hat. Sometimes I would just keep drawing, but I mean, I would say like 90% of the time it was like really helpful because it felt like something outside of myself was choosing and I just needed to like do it.
Yeah. And especially one of my lists on my map, the big list, is like meals. And the great thing about Google or Excel or whatever you're using, already numbered. So you can even just ask your phone to like roll a dice for you and it will be done.
Oh yeah. You can ask,
you don't even need
to do that. Phone.
Yeah. You can. I don't want to ask because it's going to go off, yeah. But you can ask Apple products or Samsung or Google products probably.
Wow.
Yeah. I've asked it many times to roll a dice or flip a coin. It will do that too.
Mm, wow. I feel like there's so much I don't know about my own phone.
Put it that way.
What advice would you give parents of kiddos with ARFID?
Yeah, I feel like I already kind of touched on it, but like making sure that they have the autonomy and they are having a say in things. Something else I always tell parents about is like to be very mindful of like your emotions and like the energy you're giving off, because if you're being like too hopeful and then say an exposure goes wrong, the kid's going to read that like your disappointment and then is either going to A, try the exposure a million more times to please you and then have trauma, or B, just like feel like absolute shit about themselves. So I always keep a very neutral stance. I always ask too, like, what kind of response would feel helpful? Like, can I cheer? Can I clap beforehand? That way, like, kid knows what's coming. I always also suggest like reward your kid either way. I think it's very weird that kids only get rewarded when they do good things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no, my kid sat at the table with the food they're really afraid of. And like, that is enough. Or like, kid even thought of a food that they wanted to try. And maybe they didn't even make it to the table, but like the intent was to make it to the table. I think it's very off-putting when we like take things away and reward people and reward other
yes.
people. Especially your neurodivergent kids, that shit sits, that sits with them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and the same thing of just not Googling ARFID care for my kid on Google and just like blindly trusting what comes up. Do your research, talk to people, ask around, and then stay out of ABA.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a topic point, but don't do that.
Yeah, stay far away from ABA. Where do people find competent like ARFID providers?
Is a form in the works once my brain allows me to finish the form. There is a master list somewhere made by some dietitians I wouldn't trust for ARFID care. That's why I always say try to build your community and literally just ask around. But hopefully me and Lauren are working on like making a list that's just going to actually involve like talking to clinicians and like seeing their intake forms and seeing how they're running sessions and like talking to people that use them and not just like, okay, you said you treat ARFID, now you're on this Google list.
Right. Like antidepressant ARFID providers.
Yeah. Yeah. So that will be created. I mean, it was my goal to have it done 2024. So we shall see. It's my next project to work on. But past that, literally just asking around and like people that know you could then ask me. People could find me on Instagram, people could find Lauren. Quinn is a great resource. But there's like Facebook groups too.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Well, I will definitely obviously link all your stuff in the show notes for people to find you, but maybe you can send me those Facebook groups too and I can put that in the show notes just to increase people's accessibility.
Yeah, there's one group I trust.
Okay.
There's just the one, but I will send it to you.
Okay, perfect. And Kevin, where can people find you in your work?
find me over at Kevin Does Arfid on Instagram. We're working on a LinkedIn. It doesn't exist yet, but I'm just one person doing my best. So just the Instagram for now.
Yes. Do you ever think you'll do like recovery coaching, like on your own, like outside of any company?
Yeah. Once the Remix crew gets together, it helps me. I have a bunch of people that have offered to help me open my own LLC. So it's a matter of like writing down all my thoughts and questions and then emailing all of you and being like, please answer what you have answers to. But I do one-on-one coaching outside. It's just like not super, super formally set up yet. But I do have a few people that I meet with every week and hang out with.
I just see that being such a needed and valuable service. And yeah, you should come up with a list of those questions and send them out to all of us. And I definitely can. I have some things I could help you with for sure.
Heck yeah. Yeah, that's the end goal. The end goal is to be my own person, have my own coaching thing, and then eventually bring on like other, I don't want to just be me. I would love like a peer mentor coalition practice situation. I just like don't know the legal aspects of it all, but it will be here eventually.
That's going to be incredible. I'm so excited for that.
Very excited.
So everyone go find Kevin on Instagram at Kevin Does Arfid, and I'll link everything in the show notes. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.